Welcome to You Don't Meet in an Inn. We're here today with our omnipresent GM, Austin Ramsay, to look at the third edition of Big Eyes, Small Mouth, a gaming system created by Mark C. McKinnon and published by Odd Hoss Games and White Hoof Publishing. So, let's hear your thoughts about it.
Well, I first found out about Big Eyes, Small Mouth when I was in high school, and what initially drew me to it was I was working on a homebrew role-playing game, as so many forever GMs do, and the ideas I was trying to express with the roles I was working on were pretty much done exactly as I'd imagined in Big Eyes, Small Mouth, which was specifically its attack rules, but we'll get to that later. So, Big Eyes, Small Mouth is a role-playing game system that is designed to play any type of anime, from a harem anime to mecha to pretty much anything you can imagine. It's incredibly versatile, which is another reason I love it, because I'm never sure what kind of a RP that I want to run until I'm underway of writing the setting. But at the same time, the fact that it's fluffless is both its greatest strength and its greatest weakness. It's a huge strength because it means that the rules are open for interpretation in terms of what they narrate. A weapon ability that has a level of 2 could represent, you know, a knife, eye beams, fire breath, a really strong punch, or sword. Just about anything that seems reasonable to the GM and the player. At the same time, though, because it doesn't have any fluff backing it up, there's a lot of issues with that, such as, oftentimes the amount of options for character creation can be really intimidating to the players, especially since they don't have any narrative connected to them. It really requires the GM to look over their shoulder while doing the character creation and explain that, okay, well, you've got a telekinesis ability, but that's not really telekinesis, that's your Jedi able to use the Force. Another big problem with it is that there aren't any included stats for foes in the game. So the GM has to make every single NPC, even minor ones or foes, from scratch. There's no stats for stereotypical cliche enemies like goblins for fantasy or zombies or attack drones or anything like that. The GM has to make it all from scratch, which is a huge pain. I've used this system for a couple different RPs, and every single time that's been the biggest problem, the thing that's eaten the most time of my prep. So the rules itself are pretty simple, fairly familiar. It's just a rollover system. You use 2d6, and then you add your relevant stat and your relevant attribute or skill. And there will be a target number chosen by the GM that the player has to roll over, or if it's more active opposition, such as attacking a moving target, then the target's gonna also roll 2d6 and add their defensive modifiers. Whoever gets higher succeeds. Another problem with the game is the character sheet that's included with the rules, which is actually kind of amusing because pretty much with every RP, people don't like the character sheets that the creators have provided. And I recall reading that the creators of this game knew that no one would like their character sheets, no matter how much effort they put into it. So they intentionally put as little effort into the creation of their character sheets as possible. And it's true, they're terrible. So, the character sheets that I use, I found on Neceros.com, that's N-E-C-E-R-O-S.com, And I think they're pretty good. They seem to be modeled, from what I can tell in terms of style, after the Dungeons & Dragons 3rd edition character sheets, at least in terms of their appearance. So I guess we'll go on to character creation and...
Well, not yet. So what sort of games would you recommend for this system?
Well, something that a trait that this system has is that while it can do low-powered games, it certainly leans towards higher-powered Rule of Cool-style games. One of the RPs that I ran using Big Eyes Small Mouth was a low-powered, soft sci-fi game, and that went really well. But, as with anything with this game, it takes a lot of GM oversight. And you can always feel that even when you're aiming for low power, the game just, sort of implies to the player through the mechanics and the available abilities that the player should be going for broke in what they do. So, I guess if you want something that's gritty, look elsewhere. This game can do low power, but I don't really think it can probably do gritty that well.
One thing I've noticed with this skill set is that there's not a lot of passive skills. So things like perception and resistance, there's physical resistance. Do you think that's because it's stylized after anime, which from all of my experiences with that, which admittedly isn't very high, is it because that's more action set? Or is this a case of just having far too many options?
Well, there's two parts to the answer to that. And the first is that there are defensive abilities, both for resisting poisons and mind-influencing effects and just flat-out normal damage, but they're all attributes, not actual skills. And so they sort of have a tendency to blend in with all the other options that are available. I think if I recall correctly, the ability that provides protection against mental effects is called Mind Shield. And that protects against people trying to scan you telepathically or mind control you. I think it might also provide protection from possession.
Mm-hmm. But that doesn't leave a lot for, hey, check out your area and see if there's any threats, or can you see someone approaching? And there's not a lot of, from what I see, like, opposed roles.
Well, actually, there is, there are two attributes that are specifically for what you're describing. Mm-hmm. There's, heightened senses, which you pick a sense and you get a large bonus to it. Actually, and then there's also super sense, which is the exact same thing, but a much larger bonus. So, kind of, counterintuitive and terms of including both, in my opinion. And then there's heightened awareness, which is more of just a general awareness that provides a smaller bonus than heightened sense, but I guess just affects your situational awareness compared to how well you smell or something. And then, of course, there's other abilities that allow you to have alternative forms of perception, such as infrared sight.
Yeah. I guess with me, that it feels like that should be addressed in a very baseline amount of power, not the super senses, obviously, but, I mean, normal human perception should be accounted for. But that's, I guess that's from my point of view of playing very low-powered games, where we're starting to introduce elements like laser eyes, and it's not focused on that aspect of role-playing or gameplay.
Yeah, there. When you are aiming for a lower-power game, like when I ran my science fiction game, you lower the point value of every individual character, and so that allows for less points to be spent on wacky attributes, and so characters become more reliant on their base statistics. And in the example that we've been using of perception, the mind stat is what would be used for rolling. So you'd essentially just be rolling 2d6 and then adding your mind which so human average is supposed to be at a level of 4.
Right. And you haven't explained how critical successes and critical failures come into play when you're rolling 2d6s.
In all honesty, a lot of the times they're kind of forgettable because of the fact that it's not as obvious as, say, in D20, where you get a 20 and everyone gets excited, or GURPS, where you roll a 3 and everyone loses their mind, because it's based on the idea that if you manage to roll an amount higher, or 7 points higher than your target number, then you manage to get a critical success, and if you fail by 7 points or more, then you get a critical failure. But a lot of times, this doesn't come up, because it's got the... Using 2d6 creates a pretty strong bell curve, although not as strong as more dice, such as in GURPS. But, So the numbers are going to average around 7, so it's pretty easy to plan for the difficulties of challenges based around the strengths of the players, and so you're not going to get all these really out there critical rolls. The one exception is that there is an ability for attacking called Critical Strike, where if you happen to roll a 12, it counts as a critical hit, even if you don't succeed by more than 7.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the one case where you do get the sort of excitement.
Mm. Okay. Well, I think that in very strange, strange way of looking at it, considering the system and the types of encounters that you'll find with this, but it's almost a more realistic gaming tool, where I know that depending on the rules and sometimes depending on the house rules, you get a natural 20. And you succeed no matter what, even if your roll wasn't high enough to succeed. And here, it's only when you go above and beyond or below your target that you really mess up or you really succeed. And I think that that's conceptually interesting to me.
Yeah, there's a couple games that do that. You're right that it is, in a way, more realistic. So I guess it really depends upon what you're going for in terms of the feel for the game. I think, if I recall correctly, that the rules do have some malleability as to what you can include and what you don't want to include. For instance, if you want to make the game grittier, then there's a shock value stat where if your character takes that much damage, then they are stunned, assuming that they fail the subsequent roll.
Right, and the shock value is defined as...
It's supposed to be essentially your character's resistance to pain.
Well, no, I mean calculated.
Oh, it is 1/5 of your character's total HP.
Okay.
There are other things that modify it, but that's the base value. So... It can come up depending upon the types of attacks that are available in-game and the amount of armor that's available, both of which can vary quite wildly depending upon the game that's being played. Okay. Like I keep saying, this game requires a lot of GM oversight in terms of what is and isn't allowed.
What kind of games don't you recommend for this system?
I would not recommend any games where you would want basically realism.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that this game can handle realism at all. I mean, you can do low-powered games, but even then, it's going to be low-powered and unrealistic, as opposed to low-powered and realistic. It's certainly not simulationist in any sense of the word. It's supposed to be anime, and it accomplishes that full-heartedly.
Looking at the character creation, I personally wouldn't recommend introducing this to beginner characters unless you're willing to create the characters for them yourselves, because, I love customization, and I was overwhelmed with a plethora of options. And I feel that it's very easy to make a very unbalanced character and a very useless character, even.
Oh yeah, that's entirely true. There's like I said, this I keep saying this game requires a lot of GM oversight, and the character creation is definitely a big part of that oversight, not just trying to make sure that the character has the right fluff and feel for the game that the GM wants to go for, but also that they are, you know, strong in their purpose. There's a lot of abilities in this to account for all the variabilities in anime that don't have a whole lot of use a lot of the time. I think that the game does do a fairly good job of representing that with the point system, that abilities that are extremely niche are worth very little points, and ones that can be used for a wide variety of tasks are worth a lot. But it's still quite easy to make a character that's not too useful, I suppose.
I think it's also important to point out that there's a suggestion guide in the back that reassigns point values of the skills based off of the genre of game that you're playing.
Yeah, the skills, it's actually interesting that this point variability that you mentioned only applies to the skills in the rule set, not to the attributes. Because if you were trying to take super senses in, I don't know, a very normal, everyday, I guess if you're playing like a horror investigation game, and you're playing just normal teenagers, you'd think that maybe the ability to see infrared might be worth more points than normal, but that doesn't change. However, the skills such as engineering or gaming, which is actually skillness, or knowledge of the occult, they offer up options on how much each of those skills should cost for each genre. I usually just go with the multi-genre point value, but then a lot of the time I end up just running the All-Star game that I'll be running for the podcast later on.
Okay. Do you have anything else to add?
Well, I think the All-Star game that I'm going to be running is great because it shows the adaptability of the system. And it's a lot of fun because it's really good for new players, since a lot of new players are unsure about how they're supposed to behave at a in a role-playing game. And this allows them to say, "What would Batman do?" Assuming that they're playing Batman.
Well, I think most of us do that in everyday life, though. Eat some corn.
Yeah, it's fun to run. I've run this twice before, and things have always turned out interestingly, and so I'm looking forward to running it again for a third time, and maybe at some point in the future. But since I usually do use this to introduce new players to the game, both people who are new to role-playing games and people who are just new to the system, I usually do pre-generate the characters. I just have the players say, what are some aspects of the character that they want to include? For instance, with Batman, he's had so many interpretations over the years that you really have to say, okay, are you playing Nolan Batman? Are you playing Arkham Asylum Batman? Are you playing Adam West Batman? Are you
I
playing.
believe there's a player who's been talking about doing 60s Batman with Nolan's voice, which
Yeah, that'll be interesting if it
I
comes up.
hope it does.
Yeah, so I have actually run through Batman before in this, and it was based on the Arkham Asylum game interpretation. So I have some experience in creating Batman, I suppose, for this game.
Okay, well, let's move on to character creation then. Okay, so the character I chose to do. Well, first, explain your All-Stars game a little bit.
Okay, so the idea of the All-Star game started when I was, I don't know, like 5 or 6 or something, and I'd be running around in the backyard, in the fields, in the playground with my friends. And we'd all decide that we'd want to be characters from some movie or cartoon or video game or what have you. But a lot of times we wouldn't want to be ones from all the same universe. Like, no one always wants to be all the same Power Rangers. So we'd end up with groups of kids playing together, and one would be RoboCop, another one would be Sub-Zero, a third one would be the Terminator,
Yeah.
another one would be like Spider-Man.
I had the opposite problem. Everyone wanted to be Sailor Venus, but only the prettiest girl got to be her. I was never Sailor Venus.
Oh.
Not bitter about it at all. Let me just.
So that was basically the idea of it, called it an all-star because you had all these starring characters
Oh, wait,
all.
you'd actually named your game?
Yeah, the name All-Star came from way back then.
That's adorable, Austin.
So, yeah. Playing with the idea of the All-Star game for ever, pretty much.
This is completely off topic, but I feel like the world needs to know. I had a game that had a name when I was, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 7. Playing with my friend in the park, and we would name it. It was called Black Glove, because. He saw the name in the TV guide. It was like a, I don't know, this movie. I should check it out, actually. And he thought the name sounded spooky. So we would play a game called that. And I think we were like spies or, I don't know, people who rolled around a lot and
Like,
rescued things.
yeah, sounds about right for a kid's game.
Yeah, so I probably shouldn't laugh at you too much for having a game with an actual name of it. Maybe it was Velvet Glove. Okay, I have to Google this one more time.
So the All-Star game, everyone's going to be playing different characters that are well known in popular culture. We'll see what people come up with. Last I heard, we were looking at Earthworm Jim and Batman, as you mentioned, and Lumpy Space Princess. So we'll see what the final roster ends up being, because Neve seemed kind of unsure about what she'd be playing.
Yeah.
So one thing with Big Eyes, Small Mouth is that since it is a universal game, it uses a point buy system, with 100 character points being human average, up to about 200, and then 200 to 300 is supposed to be heroic, 300 to 400 is supposed to be mythical, and 400 to 500 is, I think, super heroic, and then there's about every 100 points after that is another category. I pretty much never bother going higher than 400 because even at 400, you've got so many points that you can make characters who are basically demigods. I think more than that is, you're getting into Dragon Ball Z territory, which obviously this game was intended to be able to handle, and I'm sure it could, but I prefer my games generally to be more low powered, so I don't think I'll ever touch anything above 400 points, at least to start off.
Low powered.
So after the GM decides what the starting character points values are, the next step is to choose the values for each of the three main stats. Now, the three main stats in Big Eyes, Small Mouth are body, mind, and soul. Body represents strength, endurance, dexterity, agility, all that good stuff. Mind is a character's critical thinking, intelligence, perception, knowledge. Soul is their luck, their willpower, their force of personality. So what did you want to do with Lumpy Space Princess?
Well, I have done some pretty dedicated research into the show leading up to this, and I decided that she's a very strong and strong-willed person. Also, I assume body is her lumps, so I'm giving her an 8 body.
So, just to be clear, 4 in each of these stats is supposed to be human average.
Yeah.
So.
But she's punched herself smooth for the Nice King, so she's both incredibly strong and can take a lot of damage. Also, mechanics speaking, I want her to be sort of an aggro character who takes a lot of damage.
Yeah, so that makes sense. Body and soul both govern your hit points at the end of the character mm-hmm. creation, so it's good that you have above average for both of those.
I'm going for a 4 for mind, because she does have the mind of about a 15-year-old girl, but she's not also particularly stupid, just very self-centered. And 6 for soul. Not so much for the focus or compassion, but for the side of just being a very willful person.
Yeah, she got that in spades.
Yes.
So after you pick the main 3 stats, the idea is generally to then move on to a character's attributes. However, I prefer to then go on to the character's defects, because this way it buys you a couple extra points so you know where you stand with your character in terms of the amount of points you have to play with in picking your attributes and skills. And if you really need to, you can get a couple more defects, but I feel that more than attributes, really, the defects of characters have defined them better in terms of the player's image of their character in their mind.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another reason that I like to take defects almost right off the bat.
Me, I like going through the whole character creation process without doing any of the point values to begin with, and just when I'm making a character-based character, which is basically all the time, I go through and I pull out everything I think sounds right, and then worry about point value later if I'm over or under. But the defects I picked.
Yeah, well, actually, what you bring up a good point, that actually is the best way of making a character in Big Eyes, Small Mouth, is to just look through all the attributes and skills and write down every single one that interests you because of the fact that there are so many, and then just slowly whittling down the list until you meet the character points, which is another reason that I like to do the defects, is because you know what your total character points is going to allow before you start whittling things down.
Yeah. So I have her as easily distracted by gossip at only level 2, because I don't feel her character... to be fair, in Lumpy Space, she gets distracted by prom coming so badly that she kind of ignores Jake being turned into a Lumpy Space person. But she's matured a little bit since then, so it's only at the second highest level. So that will give me negative 2 points. And I gave her level 3 in Guide Magnet, which wasn't meant to be necessarily actually guys all up on her lumps, but she does have a tendency for wild animals to attack her, and I kind of... And she perceives that as attraction, but I like to... Well, she feels that a lot of men are always up on it or her, and she does have a lot of people attacking her, so that's the fluff that I have with that. And I gave her unappealing level 3, because Lumpy Space Princess.
So just to explain what each of those does... Easily distracted is supposed to make it so that the character has trouble focusing on anything other than what they're distracted by and tends to fixate on that. When I made Batman, I gave him easily distracted crime.
Justice.
Yeah. Guy magnet, which can also be girl magnet or guy girl magnet or
mm-hmm.
you know, however you want to define it. It's just supposed to be that your character tends to attract a lot of lustful or romantic attention from people.
Unwanted,
yes. Or not necessarily unwanted, but no, problematic.
Okay.
Is supposed to be the point. Like, characters who might seem, you know, like a good romantic interest for your character, but turn out to be stalkers, or have extremely dangerous, jealous partners, or maybe they're just trying to use you in some way. That's sort of the idea behind it. And then unappealing, that might be manners, it might be physical appearance, might be smell. Just the character is, you generally don't want to be around them. And there's a whole bunch of defects that are available in the rule book. Another one is hounded, which is the idea that you're famous for some reason, but it's negative. Like, you might give Spider-Man hounded, perhaps, depending upon how strongly you want to recognize the Daily Bugle's efforts to tarnish his name in the public's eye.
Well, in the newspaper comics, which I follow because they're ridiculous and Spider-Man is pretty 100% inept, right now the editor, which I know... Boo, I forget his name.
J. Jonah Jameson.
Thank you. I don't know why his name slipped my mind for a second. He's taken Iron Man's old suit and is basically trying to kill Spider-Man. It's pretty enthralling in a, this is a horrible, horrible story. And for some reason, his face is projected onto the Iron Man mask. So it's this, like, mustached man chasing Spider-Man all the...
Bizarre.
You should check it out, listeners. Of course, this is going to be way in the past, so go through those archives. You can see Spider-Man sighing a lot and not using his powers ever, and being shown up by little girls quite a lot.
I'm sure this is all very much part of the Marvel 616 canon.
So, moving on.
So, the next step after picking the defects is to go on to attributes. And this is where the bulk of the character selection is going to be, because attributes covers so much. The only thing it pretty much doesn't cover is a character's skills, which is basically, like, a lot of it is sort of trades knowledge.
Yeah.
Or, I don't know, fairly basic skills otherwise, like driving, but yeah, most of it's going to be in your attributes.
Mm-hmm.
So what were the attributes that you ended up taking for Lumpy Space Princess?
Well, first I'm going to say that one thing really bothered me, and this will probably come up with character creation a lot, where I don't like a lot of vague instructions that can lead the characters to having way too much power or way too little, and maybe I just don't abuse the system enough, but there's a character attribute called features, where you can choose basically any kind of feature that gives you pluses to your roles, and it was just so vague to me that it bothered me a lot.
Actually, that's kind of amusing, is that I do agree with you that is a problem that BESM has, is that there are a couple attributes that are extremely vague. One of them, I think it's dynamic powers, basically just says select an area.
Yeah.
And you can do anything with that specialty that you have.
Yeah, and I feel like it's necessary when you're trying to make an all-inclusive game, especially when dealing with anime, which powers can be pretty varied and unique. But I don't know, as a player... Maybe it's just because maybe I'm too timid and reluctant to cheat systems, but I don't like that. Well, I don't like all this power in my hands.
Again, going back, this game constantly requires GM oversight. Mm-hmm. I mean, once it finally gets into play, then it evens out and becomes more like a typical RP, but during prep, there's so much GM oversight. But going back to the features ability that you spoke of, I think that's actually one of the better abilities, although it is kind of vague. It does give you actually a fair number of examples of things you can take that it falls under, and the idea is for them to be really niche things that will almost never come up in gameplay.
Well, some of it is just, like, attractive.
Yeah.
And then, but then, like, what is, like, what kind of roles would that
challenge? I see what
and
you
then,
mean.
Like, how much, and I guess also if you're stylizing a character, you're sort of, you're penalized for making things too specific and too attuned to your character. In my idea, anyway.
Yeah.
But moving on to the attributes I chose, because I feel Lumpy Space Princess is a very tough character, and because I'm trying to model her after being a tough character, I gave her two levels of armor and made it homogeneous. So the idea that her hair or whatever's covering her.
Her lumps?
No, the lumps are something else. But some that it is harder for blows and everything to get through and to harm her.
And actually this is a good attribute to start with, because another reason that Big Eyes Small Mouth is both extremely variable and requires GM oversight is that almost all the attributes can be modified in some way with variables and restrictions. In this case, Christine has taken the homogeneous variable on her armor, which means that there's no weak points to the armor, so no one can make called shots on areas that are less armored than other places. Now, this is natural armor that Lumpy Space Princess has, and so you might think that, oh, well, obviously it should be homogeneous off the bat. But the rule set gives examples of a dragon's soft underbelly, for instance, would perhaps have lower armor rating than the rest of it.
So the next one is combat technique, which I guess we should describe her weapons first. I decided that she's going to be just a natural... natural is not quite the right term, but that she's not going to use any man-made weapons, so she's going to flail about and bite people. As you do. So the flail is linked to her bite, which means that if a bite lands, then the flail lands. And the bite has Tangle 1, which usually is used to represent a net or some, like, vines or something that tangles up a person that has HP 5. But I just have that she's so on him that
they can't really defend themselves, and they're tangled up in her as she flails
her noodle arms, and her bite has penetrating too because she's got sharp teeth.
So that means that the target's armor is less effective.
Yeah. So her quote unquote techniques are blind fighting, because with the fluff wise she's just goes into a rampage and flails about and nips and kicks and, mm-hmm. well, not kicking, no legs. So that gives me no penalties to fighting invisible opponents, fighting in the dark. Deflection, so I can just cold clock melee weapons out of the air. And hard boiled, which...
That actually is one of the abilities that boosts up shock value. So it makes you more resistant to pain and less likely to get stunned from powerful attacks.
And leap attack, because I like the image of her just jumping on people and biting them. And that just gives you a bonus if you have higher initiative than your target and are able to leap upon him. And she also has... So that would be four levels, because each new technique you add in a new level. Right, and you've explained that there's levels, but of course there's price differences for the levels, and certain levels their prices go up linearly, and then some are exponentially.
Well, it's actually not the price of the attribute that increases exponentially.
Okay.
It's actually the effect of the ability. For instance, if you take the flight ability, it is going to cost you, I believe, 8 points for every single level you take of flight. You take the first level, and your character can fly at 10 kilometers per hour. You take the second level, they can fly at 30 kilometers per hour. The third one will get you 100 kilometers per hour, and mm-hmm. after that it's 300 kilometers per hour. And the idea is that it, roughly speaking, triples for every level that you take. Other ones double every level that you take. And then there are ones like armor, where it just increases your armor value by 2 points for every single level you take, and thus increases linearly.
Oh, okay. I definitely misread that. I gave her one level of defense combat mastery, which raises her hit points, correct?
No. When you make a defensive roll against any form of attack, then you add, it increases your defense combat value. We'll get towards those at the end, because there's some derived values, some derived stats that you won't know what their values will be until after you've done all of character creation.
Mm-hmm. So I gave her one feature, which was animal empathy, because
her living with the wolves.
Pretty much. She has flight, of course, and two levels, so she goes 30 kilometers an hour. And I didn't give any limitations with it, because I haven't really seen too much limitations on the show, or too many. I know that it's a concentrated effort for her to fly, but other than that,
she doesn't have, like, wings or anything, so she doesn't need enough space for it, and she doesn't need, a landing strip.
Mm-hmm. Or land at all to hover. Or...
Yep.
So, melee attack. And I gave her metamorphosis, which, if she makes a successful attack roll against someone, and she does at least 1 point of damage after armor, they will shift into a lumpy space person.
So the idea of this attribute is that it's supposed to be able to represent both a vampire converting its victim into another vampire.
Or a Renfield.
Yeah, or a Renfield. Or even a wizard using a baleful polymorph spell and transforming someone into a sheep. Or basically it's unwanted shape-shifting on the target.
She has some special defenses, so it's four levels, because I gave her, special defense low pressure twice, special defense lack of air, and special defense cold, because lumpy space isn't really space, but it's obviously somewhat different than, I don't really know about lumpy space. It looks like it's another dimension, but maybe...
Who knows with that show? Special defense is actually kind of an interesting attribute, because it's one of those ones that doesn't have a number associated with it. For instance, LSP has special defense low pressure, was it? 2?
Yes.
So at low pressure 1, it means that you get a very large bonus to low pressure situations, like being in a vacuum. But,
well, not a vacuum. That would be low pressure 2.
Well, no, low pressure 2 makes you immune.
Yes.
So low pressure 1 would still apply to a vacuum, but low pressure 2 means, you know, if you're in a vacuum, you don't have to make any rolls whatsoever. You're fine.
Right.
And the same sort of idea applies to the special defense subsets, lack of air, lack of food. You know, you take one level of it and you get large bonuses towards resisting starvation. You take two of them and you never need to eat.
Yeah, that'd be good for a cold-blooded character.
Yeah, exactly. So it's, again, showing the variability of the game, but also showing how without some GM oversight, you could have a character who's just like, alright, so I take this and I don't need to eat or sleep or breathe or drink water. I'm immune to vacuum. And, this is a low-level high school investigative horror game.
Well, then they just wasted a lot of points in that vacuum.
Yeah, potentially. But, so go on.
Right, so she has telepathy with beasts. I only gave her one level because of the aforementioned episode titled Monster. With her, with the wolves, she just can understand animals with their body language. So there was no special languages, body language that I could fancy out and give her. So I figured telepathy was the closest to it.
Yeah, Big Eyes, Small Mouth, it handles languages with skills. You actually put character points into skills to then learn new languages, but it seemed more fitting, since it wasn't verbal, to use telepathy to represent this. Again, an example of, you know, the flufflessness of the attributes being both an advantage and a disadvantage for this rule set. One of the reasons that we felt that Lumpy Space Princess should only have one level of telepathy is because the primary bonus from adding in more levels and more points into the telepathy is that it makes it easier for a character to read the other, to read a target's mind.
Doing probes.
Yeah, doing deep scanning probes of their thoughts and whatnot, which obviously didn't fit with what we were aiming for fluff-wise.
So, I give her 7 levels in tough. Again, trying to focus her on, being an aggro character. Plus, girl is tough.
So the tough attribute is, like defense, combat, mastery, and melee attack, it's just, a bonus to one of the derived values, in this case, hit points. Gives you extra hit points for every level of it that you take.
Yeah. And there wasn't any weapon or combat ability that allowed you to draw aggro, so we created one called, under the unique attribute, which was taunt, and we gave it a range of 1, and we took 3 levels in it.
So this was actually kind of interesting, because I never had to use the unique attribute before, because the rules, when combined with the variables and restrictions, you can do just about anything. But surprisingly, there was nothing that mechanically caused a character to draw in enemies and force them to attack them. So we had to revert to a little bit of house ruling, and I think it seems like it'll work out fine.
Mm-hmm.
So after you pick your attributes,
well, there's also an upper one where there's a ability to pick an attribute but imbue it in an object as opposed to in your character, so you can lose it and other people can use it than the main character. And I really wanted to include her cell phone, so we decided to put in a divine relationship attached to her cell phone. So mechanic-wise, that allows you to reroll. And game-wise, it's Lumpy Space Princess calling her best friend at the time, which probably is going to be Melissa, but might change even throughout the game. And just generally talk to her, get advice. I wish that it was the ability to get a hint, but this is mostly I just want a cell phone.
So the advantage of taking the item attribute is actually really interesting, because unsurprisingly it covers every single possible piece of equipment your character might have. You would use it to represent a fighter jet, an assault rifle, worn armor, a cell phone, a supercomputer, x-ray goggles, what have you. And the reason you would do this is because any attributes that are placed into the item cost half as many points. So divine relationship normally costs 1 point per level, and so with four levels of it put in, it only costs 4 points.
I should have gotten her some can of beans and given her special defense against food starvation. As long as she has her beans, she's fine.
Yeah, that's unreasonable.
But we don't have any more points for that. Plus, it's going to be a short game.
Yeah. Another attribute that is covered is the weapons, which is the attack system. Christine already mentioned that Lumpy Space Princess has flail and bite. And the idea is that you take these attributes and you either put them as an item and have their cost to represent handheld weapons, or you just let the character have natural attacks. And so this can, again, since it's fluffless, represent anything. It all depends upon the variables and restrictions you place on them.
I guess that's something else. Sorry, it's sort of jumping around here, but that's something else that wasn't mentioned, that in Big Eye's Small Mouth, there's no way of buying items outside of your points.
Well, again, one of those things that isn't really covered too much by the rules. There actually is a wealth attribute that characters can take, but it's supposed to represent extremely wealthy characters. So someone who just has a fairly moderate income and can't really throw their economic weight around, there's nothing really to cover that. And so it's really up to the GM whether or not they want to have a homemade economy,
mm-hmm.
you know, using perhaps the price ranges from other RPs or from the internet or wherever to try and determine how much each item should cost and how much of a reward the players should get for accomplishing quests.
And there's no way of leveling up in this game.
Actually, there is.
There is?
Yeah. So this game doesn't really use a leveling up system because it is point buy, but if we were playing a game that wasn't only going to be one session, then at the end of every session I'd reward an amount of character points, usually between 1 and 10. I usually hand out about 5 or 6 points, and then players can spend that at the same values that they did during character creation. So they can, you know, buy a couple more points of armor, or they can save up and get a level of extra actions, for example. Going back to the items, though, mm-hmm. quickly, a rule that I always have is that if you've spent character points on an item, then it has limited plot immunity, so I'm not gonna have it get destroyed or anything arbitrarily. I mean, if it's extremely extenuating circumstances, then I make no promises. But if you just happen to have, a pocket computer that you found as loot, if you haven't spent any points on it, I have no qualms about if you fall from a great height and land on it getting completely destroyed and being unfixable. So that's one way that I view items in Big Eye's Small Mouth. So moving on, the next step, and the one that's usually the second last one with the system, is to pick a character's skills. We've mentioned it a couple times already that they tend to represent character knowledge or trade skills like medicine or engineering, construction, even domestic arts like cooking. So what does Lumpy Space Princess have?
She has 2 ranks in animal training, wolves.
So the way skills work in this is that you pick a general skill, in this case animal training, and then you pick a specialty, which for LSP is wolves. And you said you had two levels of it?
Two ranks, yes.
Yeah. So the way that works is that if she was trying to make an animal training check, she'd roll 2d6, add her relevant stat, which would probably be soul, so 6 in this case, and then add the rank of the skill, so another 2 for a total of plus 8. If she was using it in relation to her specialty, if she was trying to train wolves, then she'd get an additional plus 1. So that's how skills work in Big Eyes Small Mouth. So what are the rest of her skills?
Lumps, which to any other people who don't understand that, it's seduction, physical. And I have 5 ranks in that because, yeah, she does.
Of course.
And I have intimidation, street, 3 ranks. Wilderness, survival, forest, 4 ranks. And writing, journalistic, and 3 ranks.
So that's pretty much all of LSP done. The last thing is just to figure out the derived values, which are hit points, energy points, shock value, attack combat value, defense combat value, and damage multiplier. So the first one to calculate is hit points. And you do that by taking body value and adding it to soul value, which is 8 and 6, so 14, and multiplying it by 5 to get 70. And then you add an extra 5 points for every level of tough that the character has. So LSP with 7 levels of tough gets an additional 35 hit points and ends up with a whopping 105 HP. So then next up is energy points. And these are calculated by taking mind and soul and multiplying that by 5. So with 4 and 6, LSP's got 50 energy points. Energy points I find are really interesting because they allow characters to spend up to 10 of them to put in some extra effort in their action in extenuating circumstances to get a plus 1 to a roll. Or the party as a whole or one particular player can choose to spend 50 energy points and they can modify the narrative slightly. So in the sci-fi game that I mentioned previously, the players found a crate of grenades and it was only non-lethal flashbangs and, well, less lethal, I suppose. And the party decided that they really wanted some bigger boom in that crate. So they spent 50 energy points, and I tossed in a couple of fragmentation grenades into what they found in the crate. So next up is shock value. We've already talked about that a fair bit. Just to reiterate, that's calculated by taking the character's total hit points, which for LSP is 105, and dividing it by 5, which would get 21, and then adding any bonuses. LSP having hard boiled adds extra 10. So LSP has a shock value of 31, which is quite large. Next up is attack combat value. Normally this is just the average of your 3 main stats. The idea is that it requires both physical ability, perception, and the will to follow through to make a successful attack or defense, because attack and defense are calculated the exact same way. And so LSP with 4 for mind, 6 for soul, and 8 for body, which added together are 18, divided by 3, you get 6. So her base attack is 6, so whenever she attacks, she rolls 2d6 and adds 6. This can be modified by some attributes to increase the value. And her defense is also 6, but because she has defense combat mastery, that bumps it up by 1 point to 7. There are some attributes which are specialty, like melee attack, which LSP has, that increase specific attacks, which I'll get to shortly. And then there's damage multiplier. This is just 5 base and only increases depending upon special attributes that the character takes. LSP doesn't have any of them. So the way that damage is calculated in Big Eyes Small Mouth is that you take the weapon level. So we'll look at LSP's bite attack in as an example. So the weapon level of that is 2, and then you multiply it by the damage multiplier, which for LSP is 5. And then you add the attack combat value for that particular attack. Now, because of the specialty attack bonus attribute that can be taken, some attacks will have higher accuracy than others. So, because LSP has melee attack unarmed, her bite gets an additional +1 to its accuracy. So, the attack combat value for it is 7. So, 2 times 5 is 10, plus 7, 17. So her bite does 17 points of damage. So that's how, and then when an attack hits, the armor rating is subtracted from the inflicted damage. So if LSP managed to bite herself, which doesn't seem like a stretch, she has an armor rating of 4 from 2 levels of armor. And so she'll only take 13 points of damage from biting herself.
Except she has piercing on her bite.
Right. She does have penetrating 2, so she'll ignore 2 points of armor. Actually, no, I believe it's 4 points of armor rating per level of penetrating. So she'll actually ignore 8 points of armor. So she'll just bite through her own available armor and just do this full 17. So That's Lumpy Space Princess, and boiled down to a character sheet.
Yep. And I've practiced, but I can't do her voice. So I apologize, and or, you're welcome. That's all for this week. Thank you for joining us. If you have any questions, you can send them to youdontmeetaninin@gmail.com, or you can follow us at Twitter @notanin.